The next faculty member presenting at the think tank was Dr. Alan Vanook, who addressed a number of safety issues related to the use of bevacizumab in metastatic disease, specifically the use of this valuable agent in patients with prior arterial and thromboembolic events.
As always, with every decision we make in treating patients, you take the pros and cons and you weigh their benefits and risks and make your decision. So I don't believe that a global no or yes is the right answer to the patient with a history of arterial thromboembolic events. Clearly, the sum of the evidence suggests that patients who've had prior arterial thromboembolic events are at greater risk for developing subsequent events when treated with bevacizumab. And remember that the contemporary studies with bevacizumab have specifically excluded patients who had a variety of arterial thromboembolic events within a time frame, usually within a year. So I think it's prudent to think twice before you treat a patient who's had a recent myocardial infarction or arterial thromboembolic event inside the last year. But it's still a relative contraindication, because if you look at the data, even with the risk of thromboembolic events, the average patient gets benefit from bevacizumab, and it's only about a 4% incidence of arterial thromboembolic event. Now, the way I come down on it is to look at a couple of angles. One is, what's the goal of therapy? So if you believe that an excellent response to treatment might render a patient potentially curable and disease-free, and you want to give them the best shot at it, that might be a reason to use bevacizumab, even if there's a relative contraindication. On the other hand, if you have a patient with massive metastatic disease where your goal is clearly palliative, and you've got a marginal patient in terms of risk factors for these events, you might think twice about using bevacizumab. So again, there are lots of moving parts here. Now, the other thing I'll talk about is, I think there's a bit of a myth that patients who are anticoagulated can't safely be given bevacizumab. There's a fair bit of data that says that's not the case. I see patients, I think, who, frankly, there are errors on the side of treating when maybe bevacizumab wouldn't be my choice, but not treating when I wouldn't consider it contraindicated. And the main example of this sort of not treating because of a perceived contraindication is the patient who's anticoagulated, where there is no contraindication to treating with bevacizumab in a patient who, let's say, has been anticoagulated for a coronary stent placed 5 years ago, something like that.
Where did that thought come from? Obviously, in lung cancer, we have the issue of bleeds.
I presume early on, in the very beginning of the studies, there was this global angst about clotting and bleeding. In the original studies, there was an issue of should you anticoagulate, what to do about anticoagulation. And the data set is really only a sort of retrospective collation of data on how did patients who were anticoagulated do. So, you know, it's flawed in that there's the question of patient selection, why were they anticoagulated? But Julie Hamilton from Genentech has compiled their data, and I believe pretty compellingly demonstrated that if you think Avastin is otherwise indicated, the patient who's been anticoagulated can safely be given Avastin.
Are there any new data in terms of the risk of arterial events based on prior events and based on age?
I'm not aware of any. Now, Genentech has done a lot of excellent subsequent work to their original trials where they're collecting a lot of data, what's called the BRIGHT study and registry data. We may gather information, although remember the bias that will be inherent in this data set, because presumably people are thinking twice about using bevacizumab in at-risk patients. And if they're specifically only treating over 65-year-olds who haven't had thromboembolic events, they're winnowing out a better population of patients. So I'm not sure we'll get that prospective data. The main distinction with the Avastin data, at least as I look at it, is about the arterial thromboembolic events are usually more dramatic, and it's about 4% in the Avastin-containing treatment regimens and about 1.5% in the non-Avastin-containing regimens. And remember, it's not just in colon cancer. No individual study has really demonstrated a difference in the risk of arterial thromboembolic events. It's only when a variety of randomized studies are combined.
Do we know anything more about the potential mechanism of these events?
No. Lots of speculation that there's some endothelial impact. You could postulate that there's more tumor destruction and release of evil cytokines and promoters of coagulation. But again, I'm not aware of any dramatic knowledge. You know, it is important to remember when Avastin was first being studied, it's pointed to know that the cardiologists were looking at giving vascular endothelial growth factor to patients at risk for heart disease to try to improve coronary perfusion and get recanalization, while oncologists were giving an inhibitor of vascular endothelial growth factor for the opposite reason. So it's not a leap to assume that if you inhibit VEGF, you impact on arterial revascularization. But mechanistically, that's as good as I can come up with.
What else have we learned in the last year or so about safety and tolerability of bevacizumab? Anything new there?
I think we have evolving data about the policy of delaying major surgical interventions. It was empirical that we sort of came to a conclusion that 6 or 8 weeks off of the last dose of bevacizumab because of its long half-life would probably take patients away from the risk time of surgical complications. I believe the BRIGHT data has shown that if you do that, the risk of surgical complications is quite low. And so that's sort of crept into practice, certainly, which is the planned stoppage of bevacizumab 6 or 8 weeks before you contemplate doing an operation. Otherwise, I think we're also a little more comfortable that it's not out of the question to use it in patients with CNS, with brain lesions, and with lung lesions, although I still, for example, I saw a patient just this week who had extensive pulmonary metastases from colon cancer, had a dramatic response to a bevacizumab-containing regimen, but they cavitated, and so I didn't know what to do, but my instinct was to stop the bevacizumab because of the cavitating lesions, and I'm still concerned about the risk of hemoptysis in patients with cavitary lung lesions.
So has that been reported with colon cancer?
No, clearly not. But part of this is, again, this is in the palliative setting. A patient who's doing very well has had a robust response. I'm not going to cure him by pushing the bevacizumab. So again, I think a lot of this is a moving target. And, you know, does what happened in squamous cell cancer have any applicability to this? I don't know. But you still have to make these judgments when the patient's in the room with you.
What about the posterior encephalopathy syndrome? Can you talk about that?
Well, I've never seen it. I've had a couple of patients who had unexplained neurologic syndromes before we knew that this existed, so it's possible that we saw it. I think that's a cost of doing business with these agents. I think you need to be aware of it.
Can you describe what it is and what the incidence is?
I think the incidence is, we may not really know the incidence. There are a handful of case reports. And what it is, appears to be, is a capillary leak syndrome in patients getting bevacizumab. Appears possibly to be related to patients who have worse hypertension on bevacizumab. And it's a sort of diminished mentation, almost seizure-like activity, patients with lip smacking. You know, this is how it's described. I've never seen a case. The real issue, I think, is distinguishing a stroke or a bleed from this reversible posterior leukoencephalopathy. And we are now more likely to do scans on patients who have sort of unexplained neurologic problems. And it's not out of the question in my mind that some of the strokes that were categorized in the early going with bevacizumab may have been this, and we just didn't really work them up adequately. But again, I've never seen a case, possibly because we err on the side of stopping bevacizumab if patients are having squirrely kinds of symptoms.
The audience poll question related to Dr. Vinook's topic was as follows. Agree, disagree, or in between. With informed patient consent in specific clinical situations, it's reasonable to use bevacizumab for patients with metastatic disease who've experienced an arterial event 6 months previously. 2/3 of the audience disagreed, and Dr. Vinook began the faculty discussion by commenting on a question from the audience about the relationship, if any, of dose of bevacizumab and these events.
I'm unaware of any data that shows any relationship between the dose of bevacizumab and the risk of those events. And one of the flaws in the pooled analysis, of course, is these were a variety of doses, although the doses more or less were 5 mg per kg, were based on the frequency of the use of bevacizumab. So although one of them was the high-dose bevacizumab regimen in FOLFOX, but I'm unaware of any data telling us that one dose or another has a differential risk.
What about low molecular weight heparin or aspirin in these patients?
I personally use aspirin in elderly patients, especially this age group that Alan just mentioned, over 65 years old. I mean, there are data that we should all use aspirin when we're over 40 anyway. And that's one of those things that I actually take every day if I don't forget it. And it's very difficult to conduct a prospective trial randomizing patients to aspirin, no aspirin. So I think we have to make oncologic sense out of it, since it's safe to give from all the data we know, and it makes some sense. I use it in my clinical practice, and we'll probably never see any clinical trial being done regarding this issue. I don't use low molecular weight heparin just for convenience purposes, cost issues, etc.
Rich, you're going to talk later about chemotherapy in older people. What about Bev in older people without cardiovascular disease, but just the person in, for example, in their 80s?
Well, I don't think we have a lot of data to suggest that it's tolerated worse in older people unless they have a history of an arterial thrombotic event and are over the age of 65. So I routinely use it in my practice without consideration for age, but I do consider the arterial thrombotic history.
Dan?
Two things intersecting. One is the databases on people in real life getting bevacizumab, and Axel might comment on this. And the data to date in quite a number of thousands of patients show that the toxicity is not much higher than clinical trials. The other data set is the data which shows about 80% of people get Bev in first line in the United States. You don't want it at 100%. I think people are doing a good job of giving people Bev in the right setting. That's why the data from the real-life setting is no different, at least at this point, from the controlled trials.
Howard?
I just wanted to emphasize a point that Alan made, is that in the toxicity analysis, the risk for 65 was greater and the risk for recent arterial event was greater, and the risk of both of them was the greatest, but they all had at least the same benefit in terms of survival. So I think in part of the informed consent discussion, when I speak to a patient, I tell them, your risk of having another arterial event may be up to 10%, but this is also likely to prolong your life by 33%.
So an interesting question would be, if we believe that the benefit from bevacizumab is adding 4.5 months to survival, does that change our willingness to take the risk?
Neil?
I agree with Rich that this is one of the key points to consider with an individual patient, is what is the risk in that individual patient, and also what is the potential gain in that individual patient. And for me, the scenario that sometimes plays out is in a patient for whom cure is not possible, where we're talking about palliation, prolongation of survival, I may not, and that patient may not, be willing to take on the added risk of bevacizumab if they're in a high-risk group for having a thrombotic complication as frontline therapy. But if we're then talking about second-line therapy or third-line therapy, where we know that bevacizumab can also improve survival after failure of frontline therapy if it hasn't been used before because of ECOG 3200, the trade-off may be very different. It may be their last chance to get bevacizumab if it's ever going to be an option. And so the trade-off might be different in that setting. They might be more willing to take the chance as they get closer to their death.
Rich, what about the issue of the patient where you're going for cure? Does that make you bend the rules a little bit more?
I think so. In my practice, I'm willing to take more risks if there's more potential for a reward.
I would like to comment that for an elderly patient, which this frequently might be, if you look at the data for combining bevacizumab with 5-FU, it seems like that is, in general, a better regimen than adding a second chemotherapy drug. So I include that in my consideration, that if the choice is giving 5-FU leucovorin with bevacizumab in an increased risk of an ATE versus giving them, you know, FOLFIRI or FOLFOX, that is also going to be a toxicity question for day in and day out toxicity versus a low risk of one more serious complication.
Alan?
Well, again, consistent with all of this, given that Bev is being used by some as maintenance therapy, is the risk increased with chronicity of usage? I think that's a really important question. And of course, maintenance therapy in the patient with advanced metastatic disease, the risk may not be striking, but for example, I think one of the important endpoints of CO8, Norman's NSABP trial, will be, are there any downstream consequences of a year of bevacizumab in stage 2 or stage 3 colon cancer patients? So I think this is uncharted territory, and we have to really wonder or be concerned that there may be consequences for chronic usage of these. Remember, most of this data we have are patients who get 8, 10, at most 12 months of bevacizumab with advanced disease, much longer exposure, and patients who then succumb within a year or so. So you may not get the downstream information on what their real risk would be. So I think you have to be very cautious about just assuming that Bev is good for you and should be continued indefinitely.
Axel?
2 points to that. First of all, Dan already mentioned the registration trial, the large registration trials in the United States and in Europe, the BRIGHT and FIRST-B trial, where we try to collect data on thousands of patients, so-called real-life outside of clinical trial data. And we do see, for instance, for ATEs, these arterial thromboembolic or thrombotic events, there is not a cutoff where there's no risk anymore. So patients are still on risk, and the risk kind of accumulates over time. Not that risk is higher in the end. Most of the events happen early, but a patient's never off risk for ATEs and for GI perforations, etc. The problem that I see in the adjuvant trials, and I think this is an effort that we need to promote here when we treat patients with long-term bevacizumab a year, perhaps even longer in the future, of which 70% are cured and might live 20, 30 years, we need to be able to capture those patients. We need to start a registry of patients coming off CO8 and other trials where we follow them long-term just in order to capture those events that Alan just mentioned. What do we know in the long run what will happen with those patients?
Dan, can you elaborate on the issue of using weekly Bev?
The half-life of the drug is so long that, in fact, you can give it Q3 weekly, so it's not likely that you're going to be dealing with a protective effect by giving it in smaller doses weekly. Neil, you're the pharmacologist. Would you agree with that?
Well, I think
in terms of
the
ATEs,
peak levels would be different, but the trough levels, yeah, which might matter most,
right,
wouldn't necessarily be different.
Rich, another question we hear a lot from oncologists is the bar to treat hypertension associated with Bev in a patient who has metastatic disease. At what point do you treat the patients? Do you use the same criteria for a healthy person being treated for hypertension as prevention?
You know, I'm pretty aggressive about treating the hypertension, although I always wonder if the hypertension is due to the presence in the hematology oncology clinic rather than to the patient's everyday state. And I think that there's actually some discussion among pharmaceutical companies that are developing drugs that target VEGF about prophylactic use of antihypertensives, so not waiting for the patient to get hypertensive. Again, we're dealing with older people. Is there any correlation between hypertension and the arterial thrombotic events? I don't know that anyone's looked at that. Axel, maybe you can look at that in the BRIGHT registry.
It was looked at post hoc in the IFL and 5FU studies. So the data on aspirin mostly comes from that, where the bias would be if people were on aspirin, they were probably on it for a reason, although many of us take it even when we think we're healthy. So the people on aspirin had significantly lower ATEs. People with uncontrolled hypertension, as recorded, and I agree with you, in our place, just getting a parking spot could put your diastolic at 100. So when I put people on bevacizumab, I actually start them on a baby aspirin. I tell them if you have a bellyache, go to the ER and tell them you may be perforating, and I make them buy a blood pressure cuff. And I make them take their blood pressure at home on a daily basis and bring the diary in. Because the last thing I want to do is take someone whose pressure happens to be 94 in the clinic because of all the factors you talk about and put them on diuretics and antihypertensives and overtreat.
Before Axel and Neil comment, just real quick to Alan, any correlation between the presence of hypertension and anti-tumor response?
With the current inflation, that's a $60 million question. We're all very fascinated by the possibility of a surrogate like hypertension. I'm unaware that anybody's really demonstrated it, although it's being explored.
Has it really been looked at?
Well, it has been looked at. I think one of the problems is the weakness of the data. And certainly in practice, you're not going to be measuring blood pressure regularly. And I think the inconsistency of measurement is a problem. And of course, we're treating hypertension. Different people have a different threshold. But there may be a correlation between bad hypertension and the reversible progressive leukoencephalopathy, but that's a very rare event, and that's not something to be making major decisions about.
Neil?
My observation is that my threshold for what is treatable hypertension is very different than that of my fellows, the recent trainees, for whom what I would consider mild hypertension is really high. So there's a shifting landscape here in terms of what bad hypertension is. But the anecdote is that I find that, unlike other situations where patients have mild or moderate hypertension, the patients who have it in association with VEGF inhibition seem to be more prone to having headaches associated with the hypertension, because I think it's more of the vascular effect leads to other symptoms other than the sign of high blood pressure. And so I end up treating people more aggressively in association with that observation. And I'm wondering whether other people have had similar perception.
That's interesting. I see a lot of heads nodding. Has it actually been reported?
Actually, I think we have reports on that. At least we talk about it among each other, whether it's been
published. Well, that's almost as good as reporting.
That is almost as good. I mean, now it's being public, so well, that's what this forum is for.
Anything characteristic of the headaches?
They tend to be more frequent for a few days after getting the dose. This is anecdotal. And they often tend to occur with greater intensity at night, it seems.
I mean, one of the problems, of course, is very few patients are getting bevacizumab alone. So there's a lot going on. They're on a lot of medications. It's very clear with some of the other agents that target VEGF that headaches can be a dominant side effect.
Wasn't that true in CONFIRM-1, that headaches
with PTK-787, yes. Yeah.
Correct.
And that had the peculiar posterior compartment effect that's seen in preeclampsia where their MRI changes. I don't know of any studies, though, looking at MRI prospectively in people on bevacizumab to see if there are vasculopathies such as that seen in preeclampsia.
Final comment from Howard responding to interesting question. How safe is Bev in patients with carcinomatosis peritonei with respect to bowel perforation?
Well, in the 2107 trial, the pivotal trial, I know they tried to look at that specifically and did not see a relationship. I think the question is, been raised because of the ovarian study, and that's the one outlier where the perforation rate was much higher. However, those were patients who had been heavily, heavily pretreated and probably were prone to perforations and bowel obstruction anyway because of their very advanced ovarian cancer. So I'm not sure what the answer to that is, but the GOG has now gone ahead with using bevacizumab in a first-line study, and the randomization is to, I think, 2 years of therapy. So they're going to continue it for a long time.